Bill Kustis is well known to people in this community. I think it's fair to say you don't regularly come to these meetings, so we wanted to get him here for a few days to interact with people. He's so well known for the two-source model, along with John Norman, who is a regular attendee of these meetings for many years. But you're a giant in the field, and we're honored to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce, for the invite, and also there are a lot of giants in the audience, so but I appreciate that. So to get started here, what I'll be discussing is an approach that, as you mentioned, John Norman started to develop back in 1995, and I worked with John over a number of years on refining the technique and looking at applications with satellite data. And the point being here about remote sensing is that with an ET product, there are many aspects that we need to that can be applied to, both in terms of monitoring changes in water use, improvement in hydrologic monitoring, flood droughts, for example, improve accounting for current water use, as was mentioned in earlier talks, and crop detection and potentially yield estimation. And it's important that, and I think this is relevant to this session, is we can't manage what we can't measure. Okay, we can't just rely on models, but models are very useful in combining with measurements. So I'll be showing a few applications here related to water management, drought monitoring, and related food water security issues. This modeling system started, you know, back in 1995 with the seminal paper by John Norman, and has evolved through the efforts of Martha Anderson and a host of other postdocs and researchers to develop this tool called ALEXI, which I'll briefly describe. And integrated with that is several other tools to do sharpening of the imagery as well as fusion of multi-sensor data sets. The information that we get from satellites is a combination of a suite of instrumentations, geostationary, which provide hourly but coarser resolution, down to Landsat, which are less frequent but provide the resolution necessary to resolve field scale processes. And then potentially even going further in terms of UAV and airborne imagery. This information is then combined to look at applications potentially from 30 meters up to 10 kilometers. And it's this integrative potential that I'll be discussing. There's also, if there's time remaining, I'll talk about an additional use of microwave, the Ka-band sensor, that can actually provide a surrogate for land surface temperature. And the advantage there is it can see through clouds. It's not affected by clouds like our thermal optical systems are. The only drawback is that it's large resolution, but for global applications, it has some real relevance. So first, I'll just briefly talk about this modeling system. And what I show here are an example of, on the left is sort of the prognostic modeling system that you might see presented in terms of land surface modeling, where you have information you need about the canopy and the soil that looks at root uptake and then the stomata through evaporation. And key inputs are going to be precipitation and irrigation as well as other meteorological inputs. There's a lot of parameters in these models that need to be specified often, and that can be restrictive when you look at complex landscapes. On the right-hand side is the land surface temperature, which I'll be focusing on. And the idea here is that given known radiative inputs, how much water loss is required to keep the soil and vegetation at those observed temperatures. So the temperatures act as a surrogate to what the conditions are in terms of moisture availability and other factors affecting those temperatures in terms of meteorological forcing. Now, the system, as mentioned, the two-source model, it looks at the system of equations for net radiation, sensible latent, and soil heat flux, as was described earlier by Rick, And what this system does is it partitions the energy between the canopy and soil surfaces based on the radiometric temperature that's separated between the canopy and soil, knowing the fractional cover of the surface as well as the view angle of the radiometer. With temperature constraints, the sensible heat flux and canopy fluxes from both soil and the canopy are separated. And the key element here is the latent heat flux, which in this case is either solved, at least initially, for the iterative solution either through Priestley-Taylor or Penman-Monteith, or a light use efficiency model. Here's the similar type of resistance network over a cornfield. This is actually from bushland. And just to emphasize how we're trying to explicitly treat the energy of the canopy system and soil system and the related resistances. Now, so from this original two-source energy balance model, what came next was the atmosphere-land exchange, or ALEXI model. And this was developed through Martha Anderson. And what it does is it combines a boundary layer model with the land surface model of the two-source. And basically what it does is it looks at a temperature change using geostationary data. So it looks at a morning till mid-morning temperature change, and it uses that with a simple slab boundary layer model to estimate the amount of heat that goes into the boundary layer over time. So this by combining the boundary layer with the land surface model, the actual air temperature observation isn't needed. What's needed is an early morning sounding, which is routinely observed throughout the U.S. and in other regions as an initial condition to the model to develop the model growth of the boundary layer. The other aspect is that by using a time differencing, we reduce the error in requiring the absolute temperature. In other words, we look at a temperature difference, which has less effect of knowing absolute temperature. So that's one of the paradigms of that technique. And this is just an example of application of the ALEXI model over the continental U.S. There's going to be an operational output of this model through NOAA that's going to look at computing daily evapotranspiration over the U.S. Some of the comparisons between ALEXI and NOAA have shown some interesting features that aren't going to be picked up by a typical land surface model that requires certain inputs that aren't well known. For example, there at the top, what you see is areas that are in green, which depict differences between the ALEXI and NOAA model, and where you pick up those differences are mainly in wetter regions that aren't depicted in the land surface model. In addition, irrigated areas there in the middle, again, are not well described in some of these land surface models, but with surface temperature, you can determine where those exist. And finally, depth to water table is also a difficult parameter that isn't well known in land surface models, but a consistency in the ET output over time from land surface temperature can give you an idea of where those higher water table areas exist. So this kind of information is very useful to feed into land surface models. So in addition to the ALEXI model, which is run on 5 kilometers using geostationary data, the disaggregation or dis-ALEXI feature of the model then couples having information from Landsat, MODIS, and other satellite data that's at much higher resolution, and it's coupled with the air temperature boundary layer from the ALEXI model into now a higher resolution output with the constraint that the fluxes computed at this higher resolution have to add up to the ALEXI 5 kilometer output. And this is done through an iterative and adjustment of both the land surface temperature and air temperature coupling. Okay, finally, with that information, There's also a data fusion package that's under development and is almost completed. And this is based on the STAR-FM model of Feng Gao, who's at our lab. And it was originally developed to try to interpolate between high-resolution Landsat with MODIS data that you get on a daily basis. And what this does through regression tree analysis is develop a correlation where you have both imagery from MODIS and Landsat. This then is used to distribute the more frequent observations from MODIS on a daily basis to create a higher resolution output of the information. And that is then combined with the Alexi-Disalexi system to try to create higher resolution output, which is what you need when you try to do management of agricultural lands. So in essence, what we have at this point is a system that relies on geostationary data to give us regional information, to polar orbiting like MODIS to give us daily information, and then with data fusion, attempt to get us information at the field scale. This is imagery over the corn and soybean region in Iowa. And even when you have airborne imagery, could potentially give us within field scale variability of ET and land surface conditions, crop and so forth. Here are three examples of field experiments that were conducted to validate some of these modeling techniques. And it's I should emphasize that these sort of studies require a great amount of resources. Some are funded from outside sources like NASA. Others are also heavily funded by USDA ARS. The BAREX 08 is an example of where there was a combination of the Bushland Group with other ARS labs came together to look at some of these issues related to ET and use of remote sensing. So the SMEXO2 SMACX is a corn soybean region. BAREX is irrigated crop lands. In this case, it was cotton. MEAT is corn, both and rain-fed corn and irrigated corn and soybean. In this output here, what I want to emphasize is the red line here is the LOTUS Landsat MODIS fusion package that gives us daily ET estimates. The red squares, those are the actual days where we had Landsat observations. And then this dotted red line is where we tried to interpolate daily ET just from Landsat only. The blue is the actual observations. And what you see here is the nice thing about this data fusion with the MODIS is we're able to capture some of this effect of rain. And get them out. See here where the interpolated values are down here, but the fusion picks up some of these rain events. All in all, over the course, we do get a very good correspondence between cumulative and measured ET with this type of an approach. Here's examples from BAREX and MEAT over the unirrigated cotton and irrigated cotton. One thing to point out, again, cumulatively, we do a fairly good job. But one thing to point out is even with this, oops, this thing keeps going. One thing to point out is when your resolution is such that these fields are quite small, you get these spikes in as a result of irrigation. We're still not able to pick those up even with the data fusion approach, which emphasizes, you know, high resolution data, more frequent thermal information can help us with that issue. So as we develop the model, we continue to try to make measurements over different land surfaces because there's so many unique characteristics that affect the energy and heat transport, and we need to understand how the model behaves and what modifications might be needed for certain landscapes. Here we have we've been working over irrigated rice over a vineyard in California, over a snow system in the Northwest Reynolds Creek, a USDA site, and in Spain in a Dehesa, a forest, open forest savanna site, and looking at testing how the model performs. This is using local infrared temperature measurements and local mineralogical data. And down there, you see a plot of the energy balance components, both measured and estimated. And, you know, obviously there's some scatter, there's some refinements to the model that we're looking at. In this case, you have the issue of the water, flooded water surface that causes a much different heat storage in the soil and layer that we're exploring. This is an interesting study where we're trying to adapt the model to work over snow. Currently, the model masks snow areas because we don't have a snow ET model. We've been working with the group at NOAA at revising the model over snow. And this is some data from Reynolds Creek, a USDA ARS facility in the Northwest. And what I just want to point out is the interesting feature here is that especially over the aspen stand, during the melt season, when it's still the ground surface is cold, you still have snow at the surface, you actually get positive sensible heat flux. And the reason is that radiation that's being intercepted by the trees is a heat source. So the heat flux above that canopy is actually positive, even though there's a snow layer at zero C. And that points to some issues in the future as you get vegetation intruding into the Arctic region. There's going to be changes in the energy balance that's going to facilitate snow melt and other processes that needs to be considered. So I thought that was an interesting result that we're getting that were validated by the measurements as well as the modeling approach we're adapting for snow. This is over an olive orchard in Sicily where they've been adapting the model to work in an olive orchard and looking at the measurements versus model, reasonable results, and we're looking at ways of improving that. These are data from Southern Europe. The Dehesa is a large region in Spain that's actually an agricultural region. They sometimes grow crops in those large interspace areas. They also have cattle and also pigs that eat the nuts from these oak trees. And there's some real interest in understanding how the energy and water balance is changing in that environment due to some of these agricultural practices. So we've been looking at validating the model, again, locally as well as with satellite data. So, and closer to home in California, we've been conducting an experiment looking at the multi-sensor applications in vineyards in California. And with the current drought, there's even more issues in trying to quantifying the water use in the many of the agricultural landscapes in California. We've been working with Ernest and Julio Gallo Winery. A lot of the ways they've been monitoring conditions in vineyards is at the plot or point scale with ground observations. And obviously, when you have a lot of acreage, that's not feasible, certainly long term. So they've been adopting various methods of trying to estimate ET, crop coefficients for vineyards, and looking at ways of quantifying better the water use in their vineyards. We've been conducting an experiment called GrapeX over two Pinot Noir sites in near Lodi, California, measuring fluxes from two vineyard sites, a young and an older mature vineyard, and looking at ways of quantifying ET using the techniques, the Distillexi data fusion techniques, and comparing that with the measurements at those two locations. Of course, the interesting thing is on the right there is a cumulative ET map of the area with the two vineyard sites there are right here. These two sites. And you can see there's a lot of different activities going on surrounding those two sites. Between there's an orchard field in there, there's an alfalfa field to the south, and other things, making it a quite diverse site, even though vineyards are grown throughout. This is a retrieval from Site 1, the older Pinot Noir site, again using the data fusion with the many more Landsat scenes, but then also you can see the interpolation capturing the measurements fairly well, except for some instances that we're exploring why there's a disagreement. The other thing to point out here is the Alexi output at 4 kilometers. What you see in this one is it's quite a bit lower than the dysalexia output with the data fusion, and that's because of the measurement itself is only representing a small area of that 4 kilometer landscape. And so that, you know, that emphasizes a point that you need to have both model output and your measurements matching in scale in order to do some of these evaluations. That's an example over the southern site where we're overestimating the early season, and we're looking at reasons for that. One is there's a cover crop early in the season that has quite different properties, obviously, than the vineyard. So we're looking at ways of understanding what's going on there. And, of course, the resolution is another interesting topic where aircraft versus Landsat versus the regional, and what information you can glean from these different ET maps in terms of variability within the field and how relevant that might be from a management standpoint. For example, the higher ET in the central part of that northern field really is depicted well at 5 meters. You sort of pick it up at 30, but you get a lot more information even at the 5 meter scale. We're working with Utah State University Aguirre team in getting high resolution imagery from their UAV system and looking at what information we can glean from that sort of system in terms of variability of the landscape conditions. Here we're 60.6 meters or 60 centimeters in the thermal, so we can actually start separating canopy and soil. This is a loblolly pine in North Carolina, where similar types of applications with the dysalexia are showing some interesting features. There are two sites there. One was a more mature site. Another was recently harvested, so very different land cover condition. Again, here showing the data fusion with the measurements and the blue dots, and we seem to be capturing a lot of the variability in ET. But here again, here's the site that was recently harvested. Again, the 4 kilometer scale giving a much different ET signal than right at the dysalexia scale, which again is capturing what the footprint of what the eddy covariance tower is seeing. The other interesting feature of running these types of models with different land cover is you start getting variations in water use estimation by the model based on the land cover type, whether it's agriculture or forest, and whether it's harvested or not. And so this type of information can be quite useful when you're determining management strategies to improve water yield of a watershed and other aspects. So lastly, I'll just briefly talk about the drought work. This is again based on the ET estimation using the Alexi-Dysalexia scheme, and in particular on flash drought. It turns out that flash drought in 2012 in the central part of U.S. was not initially picked up by the U.S. Drought Monitor, and that's because other meteorological forcings were occurring that were more sensitive to the surface temperature than to the water balance or the hydrologic balance that was going on in the earlier part of the year. So even though there was less stress or less potential drought was indicated by the drought monitor, the ESSI, the evaporative stress index there, the second one on that on there, was picking up in June that there was a drought potential there. This is very useful, obviously, when you're talking about doing some sort of management strategy. If you have an indication that there's imminent drought and can be picked up earlier than some of these other drought techniques. So in the end, the corn yields are going to be affected by these types of flash droughts, and They're now looking at ways of incorporating, U.S. Drought Monitor, incorporating the SE product in their drought monitoring package. The also nice thing about this drought monitoring system is, again, with the disaggregation technique, we can try and estimate the drought conditions at the field scale. Most of these drought information are interpolated and at larger scale, but it's really when you talk about crop insurance and issues related to that, you need to know how the drought's affecting individual fields. So again, there's potential to do that with the higher resolution. And certainly when you talk about riparian areas, again, it's the higher resolution that's going to give you some information about conditions that are occurring in those zones, much more than some of the coarser information. So lastly, global applications, they're moving these systems with a cooperation with NOAA and other groups, looking at, again, ET products over Brazil and in Africa, and where there's a lot less data. And that's the other important thing about trying to develop these satellite techniques is there are regions where we have very little data. Remote sensing can provide at least an indicator, initial information about what's going on in the landscape. And what we need is more validation to confirm some of these products. And that's the hope, is that we can develop these products and work with groups to provide some validation. Here's an interesting example in Saudi Arabia, where there's been, this is from 1987 to currently, an expansion of the irrigation that Landsat can give you. Okay, there are indications from GRACE, the GRACE satellite, that there's a depletion of the water table, obviously, due to this irrigation. But it's really at the fine scale. I'll leave this as the last slide, really. At the fine scale, where you can really understand what management is going on there. I mean, there's indications at these other resolutions, keeps not wanting to, at those other resolutions, but it's down at the 30-meter scale where we can really start to impose policies or regulations on water use. So I think that's something that needs to be emphasized, and I know Rick is a big proponent of that we need that higher resolution to do the agricultural management. So I just want to leave you with this last bit of information, that's with the microwave data, to point out that for global scale work, some of this microwave has some real potential. Here's an example from Alexi and the microwave on the right, the Alexi output on the left, and it shows some distinct differences, and those differences tend to be over the Congo region where, again, there's a lot of cloud cover, and in other areas where you get consistent cloud cover and can't do a reliable interpolation. The microwave data gives you estimates even under those conditions. So, oops. So that's the end of my talk. These are my conclusions, and basically I think we need to combine both the measurements and the remote sensing data that can really give us leverage on understanding water use for agriculture and for global water and food accounting and security. Thank you.